From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The U.S. is planning to conduct more joint military exercises in the Western Pacific amid China's concerns over the presence of American forces in the region. The U.S. Navy and Marine Corps propose to hold anti-submarine training and practice unit and mixed unit tactics with allies such as Japan using real bullets and bombs, according to a report in Stars and Stripes. The extent of the U.S. military maneuvers is doubled the previous ones, pushing operations much further west towards the Philippines and Okinawa, and ultimately China. Air-to-ground bombing exercises could also double from 1,300 to 2,520 annually, and gunnery exercises between ships could increase from 17 to 240 per year. The expansion of military activity is occurring while the Chinese government has repeatedly voiced concern over Washington's plans for boosting its military strength in Asia. China says American militarism in the region could endanger peace. It urged the U.S. to abstain from flexing its muscles in the region. In August, Foreign Policy magazine reported that the U.S. is encircling China with a chain of small air bases and military ports. Among other projects, the U.S. Air Force plans to lease 33 acres of land on the small Pacific island of Saipan for the next 50 years to build a, quote, divert airfield, close quote, on an old World War II air base there. According to Beijing, the Pentagon's focus to pivot increased U.S. military presence in the Asia-Pacific region is intended to counter China's increasing economic and political global influence. The Syrian crisis could end in 2 weeks if the political will to do so exists on all sides. This according to Dr. Boutani Shaban, political and media advisor to the Syrian president, in an interview with Russia Today.
The Syrian government has announced many times that it is ready to attend Geneva without precondition. The problem is with the others who speak many different languages at different places and who keep putting conditions. We just learned that the Russians and the Americans have agreed that Geneva too should be convened without any preconditions from any side. So that's fine with us. The problem is that in some countries, calling armed groups as oppositions or armed mercenaries or Al-Qaeda and Jabhat al-Nusra as oppositions. I think what we need to do is to have the people who represent political oppositions and who care about Syria and about the interests of Syria and the Syrian people. If you heard Saud al-Faisal yesterday, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, you would immediately realize that the coalition that Saud al-Faisal represents is made by parties who have nothing to do with the Syrian people. The question we would like to ask is, who do these people represent on the ground? We would like to know. Do they represent Jabhat al-Nusra or Al-Qaeda, or who do they represent? They do not represent the Syrian people. But the Syrian government will be attending Geneva too without any preconditions. And I think the progress should be made by the Syrian people. The problem we are having now is that other parties like Saudi Arabia and the U.S. assume themselves to be representing the Syrian people. And so they take the liberty to speak in the name of the Syrian people. I think they should honor their words that the Syrian people are the ones who should decide their future and who should dialogue in Geneva too, and who should reach a decision about the future of their country and about what their country would look like in the future. I think you have to differentiate between constructive parties who want a solution to the crisis and between other parties who had been for 2 years putting obstacles on the way of solving the Syrian crisis. Russia, China, Iran are parties who are constructive, who want to solve the crisis in Syria. other parties who say we will not attend unless something is done, we will not attend if Iran comes, we will not do this. Those are the people who have been putting obstacles because they have fighters on the ground who are killing the Syrian people, who are destroying Syrian cities, who have created this problem for Syria. So we have to differentiate between the two sides and know who does everybody represent. If I may speak in the name of Syrian people who live in Syria, who have been suffering in Syria, I would like to say that the first thing that the Syrian people want is for violence to stop, which is, by the way, the first item in Geneva 1 that was written on the 30th of June 2012, to stop violence by all parties, to stop armed groups, to restore peace and safety to the country, and then it is up to the Syrian people meeting around the table to put the mechanism for a political process for Syria. It's not up to these people who say, who invent stories every day in order to obstruct a solution. What we want is to restore peace and security and then start a political process, but speaking one language with one objective, which is to solve the crisis in Syria and to take care of the Syrian people, not to create a crisis at their expense and to create havoc for them. If there is a political will to end this crisis, everything becomes realistic. The issue is not the time, the issue is not the dates and weeks, the issue is the political will. If these parties have political will to put an end to the Syrian suffering, to the Syrian crisis, they can do it within a week because they can only stop the financing, the arming, the smuggling of terrorists across the borders from Turkey, and 50% of the Syrian crisis would be solved in 2 weeks' time, But all depends on the political will. It is not, the issue is neither the time nor the ability of these parties to put an end to the suffering of the Syrian people.
Although many groups on the ground have refused to be part of the Syrian opposition's national coalition, the main political parties are calling for Assad to step down as a precondition for the talks. The Geneva II Peace Conference, which was to be held at the end of November, has now been rescheduled for next month, a source told Itar Tass news agency after a closed-door UN conference in Geneva today. Meanwhile, a joint mission of UN international experts and the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, is working in Syria on the destruction of the country's chemical weapons arsenal. In September, Syria agreed to comply with Russia's offer to put its chemical weapons under international control for destruction by the middle of next year. That decision was made following threats by the U.S. to launch military action against Syria after the August 21st attack in Damascus's eastern Ghouta suburbs. The deadly attack killed anywhere from dozens to 1,300 people, depending on the reports. Last Thursday, OPCW said Syria's declared stock of chemical weapons, 1,300 tons of chemicals and precursors needed for weapons production, as well as over 1,200 empty chemical munitions, had been sealed off. Los Angeles police officials are seeking to fire two officers after an internal investigation determined that they pressured women to engage in sex acts with them in their car while on duty. This according to the LA Times. The officers have been ordered to appear at disciplinary hearings where it will be decided whether or not they're fired. Although department officials have remained tight-lipped, the allegations against the officers are detailed in a search warrant and affidavit filed by an investigator involved in an ongoing criminal investigation into the officers' conduct. The affidavit alleges that after using the threat of jail to get women into their car, the officers would sometimes drive them to secluded areas where one of the officers demanded oral sex or other acts while the other kept watch. In other cases, the men allegedly acted alone. The two reportedly preyed on at least four women when they worked together as narcotics officers in the LAPD's Hollywood division. The officers had arrested the women or used them as informants before targeting them, according to the report. In Chicago, under pressure from Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy, police are increasingly write up what are called contact cards, the forms they fill out when making street stops, raising concerns of civil libertarians that the number of unconstitutional stops and frisks are also on the rise. Through the first 10 months of 2013, Chicago police officers had filled out more than 600,000 contact cards, already exceeding last year's total of 516,500, and far outpacing the 379,000 written in 2011 when McCarthy took office, this according to the Chicago Tribune. McCarthy, the product of a New York City police department that relies heavily on the same stop-and-frisk tactics which a federal judge found unconstitutional this past summer, has been riding commanders of Chicago's 22 police districts for months to increase street stops by cops, according to numerous police sources. Meanwhile, New York's stop-and-frisk program got a new lease on life. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford discussed the federal lawsuit seeking to put an end to that practice, where last week a federal appeals court stayed Judge Shira Scheindlin's ruling that stop-and-frisk, as practiced by NYPD, is unconstitutional. The appeals court removed Scheindlin from the case, claiming she was biased against cops. Ford spoke with Robert Ganji of the Urban Justice Center's Police Reform Organization Project and Carl Dix, a co-founder of Stop, Stop, and Frisk, which has been running a campaign of direct action protests at police precincts across New York.
The appeals court decision is a victory for outgoing Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his police commissioner, Ray Kelly. However, Robert Ganji of the Urban Justice Center's Police Reform Organizing Project isn't all that upset. He says the real action isn't in the courts anyway.
Our judgment is that while litigation and legislation can be helpful, they're not the critical components to the ultimate success of the police reform movement in New York City. Our effectiveness has always depended on our ability to affect the politics of the issue and to dramatically shift the political landscape. In fact, our mantra could have been taking off from "it's the economy stupid" of the Clinton campaign to "it's the politics stupid." And for a variety of reasons, including the good work of reform advocates, the politics of this issue have changed dramatically. All the leading candidates for mayor in the Democratic primary spoke out very critically about stop and frisk. Most of them, including Bill de Blasio and Bill Thompson, who were the leading vote-getters in the Democratic primary, pledged to replace Ray Kelly. De Blasio, who all the polls show is almost certain to be our next mayor come January 1st. He's not only pledged to replace Ray Kelly, who is the police chief ultimately responsible for stop and frisk, but to end the quota system that drives bad police practice, to withdraw the city's appeal that the Court of Appeals just ruled on, and he's pledged to implement the provisions of Judge Scheindlin's ruling. So, again, while disappointed, we're confident that at most this represents a detour in the onward progress toward significant changes in police practices. The ad with his 16-year-old son, the TV ad, has been credited with helping to provide a significant boost to his campaign. I think some people think he wouldn't be the leading candidate at the moment if it wasn't for that ad. And that ad focused virtually entirely on "my father will correct stop and frisk." So in order to maintain his political credibility, he has to follow through on that campaign pledge.
Of course, whatever a Mayor de Blasio would do would be an executive decision that could be changed right by himself or by the next mayor. Would have been far better to have a judgment stand that said stop and frisk as practice is unconstitutional.
I understand that point, and I don't fully embrace that point. I think it's always tricky business, and the reforms you achieve will always be fragile if you're depending on litigation and not depending on a change in the political climate. So that I think a stronger determinant for the change in stop and frisk and for the change in a whole spectrum of abusive police practices in New York City will lay more with the politics of the issue, with the fact that the public over the last year and a half, 2 years, has been significantly educated on this issue, and that, for example, the polls show majority of the public supports changes in stop and frisk. And I think that's going to be more significant in determining what happens in the city than the outcome of litigation. I mean, we reform types have had many, many years of experience where there's a court ruling requiring changes in practices of different government agencies, and those changes never really take place because the government agency isn't committed to those changes and different ways tries to undercut and subvert what the court has ruled. But if you change the politics, you change the political climate, you change what the people, the voting public in the city really want, then you've effectively created change on the ground.
And all of that presupposes continued agitation so that the mayor doesn't change his mind.
Right. I mean, we are certainly committed at PROP, the Police Reform Organizing Project, to continue our public advocacy and organizing. I'm virtually certain that the other groups in the city that have worked on this issue will continue to speak out publicly and to organize politically on the issue. And plus, I believe that de Blasio is not just making promises to court electoral success. I think he truly believes that the way the NYPD has implemented stop and frisk during the Bloomberg-Kelly tenure has been unconstitutional, has been illegal, has represented the unnecessary harassment of people in the city, particularly low-income young black and brown men, and I think he's strongly committed to stopping it. It's not acceptable kind of thing to go on in any city.
Of course, de Blasio's position is essentially mend it, don't end it.
Right. The way we see it, and we're not sure exactly how de Blasio sees it, is mending it would mean ending the way stop and frisk is practiced today by the NYPD. Nobody objects, including people at PROP, including the most ardent civil libertarians, to police stopping people who are truly engaged in suspicious behavior. The problem with stop and frisk, the tactic that's implemented now by the NYPD, is they stop and sometimes frisk over and over and over again every day people who are innocently going about their business, going to school, coming home from school, running errands, standing in a hallway of the building where they live, and they get stopped, they get frisked, sometimes they get arrested, sometimes they get verbally and physically abused, and that's what we're committed to having stopped, and I believe that's what de Blasio will stop.
That was Robert Ganji of the Urban Justice Center's Police Reform Organizing Project. Until relatively recently, stop and frisk was not a top priority of most traditional black organizations and politicians. But 2 years ago, Carl Dix and others, including Dr. Cornel West, launched a militant civil disobedience campaign under the banner of Stop, Stop and Frisk. The organization has confronted police at precincts all across New York, leading to many arrests and prosecutions, and bringing the issue to the forefront of public attention. Carl Dick said the appeals court ruling is a setback, but it won't stop the movement.
Well, my very immediate reaction was that the federal appeals court stopped and frisked Judge Scheinlin and did a number on her, but in doing that, slapped in the face all of the people who hate stop and frisk, who breathed a sigh of relief when they heard her ruling and thought maybe something was going to be done about the way that black and Latino people have been criminalized and demonized through that racist, illegitimate NYPD policy called stop and frisk.
Some people might think the fix was in.
It certainly came through that way. I was sitting in court when the city made its arguments for the stay, and just listening to them legally, it didn't make a lot of sense because it was pointed out if they were saying, well, we would suffer irreparable harm if our cops were not allowed to stop and frisk hundreds of thousands of people. And even one of the judges pointed out, well, if this is such a bad thing, how come you didn't come to us right after the judge issued her ruling? And, you know, the city's lawyer hemmed and hawed but couldn't come up with an answer. So legally, it didn't sound like they had much to say for themselves. But essentially what's being said here is that the judge's decision, which in my opinion did not go far enough, stop and frisk needed to be ended, not a process set up to figure out how to reform it. But in issuing that decision, she created a lot of public opinion against stop and frisk, not only among the people who were tired of being stopped and frisked, but there seemed to be some fear that the cops were becoming reluctant to do that because perhaps they could get caught up in discipline for being overzealous in their persecution of blacks and Latinos. So somewhere, somewhat was decided, we have to issue a very strong statement, and that strong statement was to go beyond what the issue was in court. Because the city wasn't asking for the judge to be removed. They weren't asking for her to be chastised. But the appeals court panel took the opportunity to do that, and it is a big slap in the face.
The federal appeals court ruled that the judge acted improperly, and that seems to taint the entire proceeding, as if one has to start from scratch all over again.
Yeah, and this is the most curious part of this ruling, because the interviews that she gave, she did not comment on the case before her. And the media doing the interviews drew quotations from court rulings. I mean, the court rulings are part of the public record. They can do that. So the judge issued no improper statements. And they're almost like saying, judges should not do interviews, which judges do all the time, up to and including the Supreme Court justices. They talk publicly about stuff. And as long as she wasn't talking about a case right before her, which she wasn't, there was nothing improper there. And see, them finding impropriety in that, but seeing no impropriety in stop and frisk itself and the way that it criminalizes and demonizes black and Latino youth is the real story here from my perspective. And I'm sitting there in court listening to one of the judges saying, the judge basically was agreeing with the city that it is an irreparable harm for the police not to be allowed to stop and frisk as many people as they want, and citing drops in the number of stops to cite this harm. Then when the lawyer for the plaintiff said, well, judge, crime has dropped while the stop and frisk are dropping. And then the judge says, well, you can't bring that kind of statistical evidence in here. So in other words, statistics that favored his position were fine. Statistics that clashed with his position were not to be allowed in the courtroom. And that approach follows through in this whole ruling of staying the judge's order, allowing no remedies to be done around stop and frisk. And it points to a decision pretty high among the powers that be in New York City that stop and frisk cannot be allowed to be even reformed and slowed down, which is something that people need to reject. This is a slap in the face to every black and Latino parent who fears what's going to happen with their children if they're confronted by the NYPD, to everybody who doesn't want to live in a society where people can be treated like criminals just because of the color of their skin. And it must be denounced and rejected.
And it could also have a chilling effect on the judiciary, at least those judges that are willing to entertain suits of this kind. The judge was basically charged with being biased, that is, being prejudiced against police.
Yeah, and see, what it comes down to is it's a statement on the part of this appeals court that judges who are partisan towards justice need to watch out. Because that's what came out of this court ruling. While I didn't feel it went far enough, what the judge did is she looked at the preponderance of stops, who was being stopped, why were they being stopped, what was the outcome of these stops, and determined that this was being applied in an unconstitutional manner. No one has yet gone into this and showed why all of these stops of people who were doing absolutely nothing wrong and were overwhelmingly black or Latino was proper. But it comes down to that, don't even think about issuing a decision like this. And it's a broader message than that. It's a message to people in society who would side with people who hate being stopped and frisked or speaking out about it. It's a message, don't even step out around that. Stay in your place. Let us do this to people we determine we need to do it to. and it just has to be rejected.
And, of course, you at Stop, Stop, and Frisk have always said that the real battle is in the streets anyway.
Yes, and we're going to be taking it there in response to the ruling in the days and weeks to come. We're going to call on people to join us. And folks should check out the Stop Mass Incarceration website, which is stopmassincarceration.net, for our plans, our analysis, and everything else about not only this ruling, but the whole slow genocide of mass incarceration and all its consequences.
Carl Dix, speaking from New York.
Deb Sweet is the executive director of World Can't Wait. She spoke with us earlier today about drone strikes, the president's claim that he's getting really good at killing, and other matters of urgent concern.
With respect to the drones, there's this quote in the Double Down Game Change 2012 book that just came out, where Obama basically brags about being good at killing people.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was going to write about that today.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good at killing people.
That's amazing. What an amazing quote for a Nobel Peace Prize winner, no less.
Really. And a lot of this hubris and, very American. I always notice the way Obama seems to channel George Bush when he talks about Americans. We're all Americans. There's something there that is really essential to running the American empire.
Yeah.
That because I do it, it's good. Because we do it, it's the right thing to do because we're America. It's very, very deep in the ruling psyche of the class that runs things here. And it's unfortunately penetrated very, very deeply into the people. And we got to do something about how people think.
Yeah, and into policy. In a word, it's impunity. And as a matter of fact, last Thursday at the UN, the General Assembly called for, they basically asked for the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court to lead to end impunity. At the General Assembly, this happened last week.
Yeah, but the U.S. won't even join the International Criminal Court.
Of course not.
Last Thursday, also, World Can't Wait and some international lawyers were in Toronto protesting outside a speech by Dick Cheney. on Halloween.
Yeah, appropriate.
Right, and the headline says, well, he wasn't arrested for war crimes, even though that was the legitimate demand. In fact, a year ago, he canceled a speech in Canada.
Right.
Worried about protests and the fact that Canada has every basis to arrest him. But of course, with the government they have as tied in with the U.S. government, that's not going to happen. It seemed to be a really important political demand to raise and should dog him every moment for the rest of his life, that here's the person, most singularly responsible for creating a torture regime across the whole globe.
Yeah.
Of black sites, secret extraordinary rendition. And, I think we talked about on this program that Bush and the CIA had this view of, if you want to torture someone, send them to Jordan. If you want to kill them, send them to Syria.
Yep.
If you want them, no one ever to know what happened to them at all, send them into the hands of Mubarak in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And, all of this is just really the extraordinary outgrowth of having a U.S. that is the biggest military, the biggest economy, the biggest imperialist in the history of the world. And every day, you have to go out there and remind yourself. You know, that all of this whole military scheme they have going, it's something like 1,200 bases around the world. And it's not all public. We don't really know, just as the military budget is not public for the most part either. All of this is done to defend and extend a worldwide globalized system of exploitative production
right.
everywhere.
Deb Sweet, World Can't Wait. Thanks a lot. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, later, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.